The Solemn Monster sounds off.
I want to squash him. You turn the camera off, and I'll be naked when you come back.
Can you say the alphabet backwards?
Well, I can whip your ass backwards.
The main priority is to get the body in the proper position to the strapation dudes.
What did you just say?
Welcome to episode 294 of the Solemn Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, September 29th. 2013. I am the Solemn Monster. You can listen to the show every week on thesolemnmonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and in iTunes. And of course, if you have an Android device, there is a free app from which you can stream this show. We're a week away now from Battleground, which is WWE's new pay-per-view coming up next Sunday. 7 days away, and I don't know, you know, not really doing much for me right now. We know the main event, Randy Orton and Daniel Bryan for the WWE Championship, CM Punk and Ryback, which is now official. And it appears that we'll probably find out about some sort of Rhodes Family Shield match, if I had to take a guess, this Monday night on Raw. I'll talk about that a little bit more later on. But one of those situations where you got two pay-per-views in the month of October, and you just sit there and you ask yourself, why? I mean, do we really need two shows in October? Is Hell in a Cell later in the month not enough of a draw, you know, to where we need this completely fabricated pay-per-view to hold us over at the beginning of the month? I just think the whole thing is silly. Before we move on to Raw and all the news of the week, I just want to make two announcements here at the beginning of the show. First, I want to thank a whole bunch of our listeners, Nathan, Dennis, Luis, Zach, and Rodrigo, all of whom made PayPal donations to the show this past week. So I want to thank you guys publicly. I've already thanked you personally. You guys are awesome. And again, every time you make a PayPal donation, it goes towards helping this show to keep the show going. So if you want to make one, you could do so on thesolemnmonster.com. You'll see the little box. Most currencies are accepted. Give what you can. And just know that it is very much appreciated from me. Also, and this is an exciting little announcement here. This has been a long time in the making. For probably the last few years, and I don't really think that's much of an exaggeration, I've gotten emails and tweets and messages from people asking me, you know, are you going to make a t-shirt? You know, are you going to make an official Sound Off t-shirt? So I'm happy to announce that we now have an online store. The Sound Off Superstore is online. We are now selling Solemn Monster Sounds Off logo t-shirts. It is our first official shirt. This is very exciting. You can go to solemnmonster.spreadshirt.com. That is the easiest way to get to the store. Right now, the only thing available is the official logo shirt, so you get the logo on the front of the shirt. You can get it in multiple colors. We have it for men, for women, for kids, and there's also a Sound Off Ringer shirt. Personally, I'm a fan of Ringer shirts. I got one for myself, but you can get a regular one if you want to. It comes in all types of colors and various sizes as well. So we are now on Spreadshirt. We have a superstore, as I'm calling it, on there. Go to solemnmonster.spreadshirt.com. Buy a shirt, or three, or four. The more the merrier. I hear the holidays are coming up. Actually, the holidays are coming up. I see Christmas crap is already out in some of the stores. But who knows? Maybe the night after Survivor Series, I'll be at Raw, the Nassau Coliseum, or next year in New Orleans for WrestleMania. Maybe I'll see some of you guys representing the Sound Off, wearing the shirt. And I'll have to go over and shake your hand. Monday Night Raw this past week was live in Chicago, Illinois. Always a fun time when Raw's in Chicago or pay-per-views are in Chicago. It's probably, if not the top wrestling city in the country, it's easily one of the top two or three. And that's coming from a New Yorker. New York crowds can be fun. I've never been to an event in Chicago, but those people are crazy. So let's talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly. Some random Raw observations here. Some questions. Some head-scratchers coming out of this show, but also a fun main event. Show opened with Triple H coming out, and rather than me going through the whole thing about, you know, Triple H's 15-minute promo here, basically, he came out to make an 11-on-3 handicap match involving Daniel Bryan and most of the Raw babyfaces in the main event against The Shield. So, heel Triple H is putting his henchman, The Shield, in a 3-on-11 predicament in the main event. Okay, that's kind of weird. And usually it's the other way around. Usually you have the babyface is outnumbered by the heels, and then either he goes up against them in a gauntlet of some kind and wins, or he does well for himself, but falls a little bit short. This was the opposite of what you would normally do. And when he made the announcement, I got to admit, I immediately had these horrible, almost like war flashbacks to another Raw match that actually took place back in March of 2008. And ironically, it was Triple H who booked that match as well. It was John Cena and Randy Orton against the entire Raw roster. That was when it was going to be Cena, Orton, and Triple H in a three-way at WrestleMania. And I think each week, each man had the opportunity to book one of his opponents in a particular match. So Triple H said, well, I'm going to put you guys in a handicap match against the entire Raw roster. And so here we are all these years later, and Triple H is still at it. There's also mentioned here that Orton and Bryan would wrestle at Battleground to crown a new WWE champion, as I mentioned earlier. And I know it's all entertainment, I know it's a TV show, but still, I can't help myself. Why do Triple H and Stephanie keep giving Daniel Bryan title shots if they don't think he's worthy of being champion? I mean, you know, Vince McMahon used to hate Steve Austin, right? But he'd get title shots all the time, too. Because on TV, Austin would come out and he would say, you know, I'm your meal ticket. You can't fire me. I'm the best thing you've got. With Bryan, you have the McMahons out there basically admitting on TV, you're okay. You're a solid B+. What did Triple H say that one time? Bryan would make a good contender for the European title or the Cruiserweight title. So they've already screwed him out of the title. If he's not their meal ticket and he's average at best, then why keep feeding him title shots? So that's just one of those little lapses of wrestling logic, I guess. Kind of bothered me. We got tons of replays from last week of Randy Orton's mugging of The Miz in front of his parents. Sadly, they cut his father out from most of the highlights and just showed his mother. I guess his dad must have heat. Miz's dad must be in the doghouse. So much for his push. By the way, I just had to look it up. Miz's parents, just an FYI here, divorced when he was 11. And the man on TV that week, in fact, was Miz's biological father. His name is George, not Donnie, as I wrote on Twitter. That's actually his stepdad. His father apparently owns several Mr. Hero sandwich shops in the Cleveland area, and I must eat there one day and get my picture taken with Miz's dad. Miz came out for Miz TV. Big Show was his guest. Miz was doing his very best to pretend that he was actually a badass here in this segment. And eventually Stephanie came out. Basically, The Miz was questioning Big Show and kind of poking the bear, for lack of a better term. Why did you knock out Dusty Rhodes? That sort of thing. So Stephanie came out. I see people online who were, you know, mentioning, oh, Stephanie had notes written on her hand. I guess there was a screenshot of her with crib notes on her hand. Who cares? It's not really a big deal. Everybody does it. Not just The Rock, either. I mean, Chris Jericho's been caught, I think, with it, and other people, I'm sure, do it all the time. You got a lot of shit you got to remember. The only thing I could criticize them for is if you know you have notes written on your hand so blatantly, then probably not a good idea to be waving your hand around and keep your hand open. And too bad, you know, the production people weren't clued in on that either because they got a pretty good shot of it. But it's not her fault. You know, you got to remember a lot of crap. It's not easy. So, in the end, Stephanie told Big Show to knock out Miz, which he did. So we didn't get any crying Big Show on this show. No crying Big Show, no sobbing. I don't want to do it. Nope, no complaints. He didn't hesitate at all before he knocked out The Miz. And all I could say to that is, see? Everybody hates him. They did one of those fan polls they love doing now on the app. And I still ask the question, what is the big deal with the app? I don't get this obsession that they have. They call it like the second screen experience. I know when they go to commercial, you can watch on the app like what you're missing during the commercial break. You know, the app is free, and I haven't noticed any advertising in the app. I don't see what they get out of it other than being able to say, oh, we have X number of people who have downloaded our app. You know, look at us. We're so special. I don't see how they're making money off it. I don't see what the big deal is. For all the shoving of the app down our throats and those, God, I mean, God, when they have Michael Cole sit there with a phone in his hand, which I think they did this on this past week's show, you know, they've always showed us the iPhone. How do you install the app on the iPhone? This time he was like, well, for those of you who have Android devices, Jerry Lawler has an Android, and so he'll show you how to install the app. Like, we're all so fucking dumb, we don't know how to install apps. You know, we bought these phones And until Michael Cole sat there on Monday night and actually showed us how it's done, we all sat there scratching our heads like Neanderthals going, boy, you know, I have this phone, but I wish I knew how to actually install apps on this phone. All we have are the native apps. I haven't been able to install anything. Thank God WWE was there to show me how it's done. It's just so ridiculous. So they did one of these polls to determine who would face Randy Orton later in the night. Rob Van Dam, R-Truth, or Dolph Ziggler. RVD won quite easily. I think he had 56% of the vote or something like that. And apparently Randy Orton, according to Jerry Lawler, is still WWE champion. Because when Lawler stood up to announce the results, he mentioned that the winner of the poll would be wrestling the WWE champion Randy Orton. So I guess in some parallel universe, Orton never actually did lose the title. So we had Orton versus Van Dam. It was, you know, a good match for what it was. It ended in a double countout. Certainly not the best match they've had with each other. This was all about RVD's destruction. This was Randy Orton, I can't even say beating up Van Dam or attacking Van Dam. This was the utter destruction of Rob Van Dam at the hands of Randy Orton, to the point where it almost went too long and it felt kind of uncomfortable. He literally just beat RVD all around the different sides of the ring. I think he ended up giving him one of his draping DDTs from the top rope in the corner. I mean, he beat this man to pieces, to the point where you thought this might be RVD's swan song. Maybe he's going to be taken out of the championship match at Battleground because he hasn't signed a new deal or whatever the case may be, or his contract is coming up soon. I hear about, you know, Van Damme's contract coming up and all this. I don't know how true that is. My understanding was that Van Damme had a clause in his contract where after the initial 90 days, he would get some automatic time off. So I don't know when the contract kicked in, but he made his debut at the Money in the Bank pay-per-view. A couple more weeks will be 90 days, so he'll probably just go away for a little bit and then come back. I mean, maybe they're trying to sign him to a new deal. I don't know. It certainly would make sense based on what they did to him here, the way they beat him down. And you would think, okay, that's it. We're not going to see RVD for the rest of the night, but you'd be wrong if you actually thought that. We had a backstage segment, Stephanie McMahon and AJ Lee. Stephanie gave AJ a copy of Triple H's new DVD, which I have not seen. I've heard good things about it. I did see the one clip they posted on .com where he talks about going to WCW and negotiating with Eric Bischoff. I thought that was an interesting story. And as some of you have pointed out, apparently on the DVD, he gives credit to Mick Foley for helping get him up to that next level in his career, which is nice to hear because you don't hear him talk about that a lot. There's been a whole bunch of Triple H DVDs. I've seen some of them. I've never really seen him strongly put over Mick Foley. So I haven't seen this one yet either, but based on what you guys are telling me, he does a pretty good job of putting Foley over, so that's nice to see. CM Punk. This was all about CM Punk returning to Chicago, hometown boy. I can't even begin to describe the pop he got when he came out. It was monstrous. The people went nuts for him. He was wearing a Chicago Blackhawks jersey. Punk is a huge hockey fan. He told this great story about, you know, how the team was down and they fought their way back, and that's basically what he's going to do now in his feud with Paul Heyman. Heyman came out. Heyman was great here. Heyman came out singing, calling himself the best in the world, and he came out on a motorized scooter, which is so much better than a normal wheelchair. And so Punk basically said to him, you know, what are you going to do when I come after you and your two goons can't get to me fast enough to save you? And Heyman tried to back up. He tried to go in reverse with his scooter. He pretended like it didn't work. It had stalled on him. Punk ran after him, and just before Punk could get his hands on Heyman, he was attacked by Axel and Ryback. I thought the whole segment here, this whole beatdown and everything about it, except the end, which I'll talk about here, but I thought this whole thing was so well done. You know, Punk is in that zone that The Rock was in when he was a babyface with Steve Austin on top. So there was a period, if you remember, during the Attitude Era where, you know, Rock had been a babyface very briefly. The fans turned him for like 2 months. Then they did the whole corporate turn at the Deadly Game tournament at Survivor Series and Rock went heel. But many months later in 99, when Rock finally went back babyface, there was this period of, you know, a good 6 or 8 months where he and Austin were both the two top baby faces in the company. Austin was clearly number one, and he was the WWE champion. But Rock was right there. Like, Rock was nipping at his heels. He was over like gangbusters. And I feel like Punk is kind of in the same position now where you know he should be on top, but he's just kind of killing time with this Heyman, Ryback, Axel stuff right now. It's beneath him almost. But when this is out of the way, he'll be right back in the main event. He'll be right back in the title picture. Maybe he'll be an ally of Daniel Bryan against the administration. So he's kind of in that zone right now, very similar to the way Rock was in 99. And Punk and Heyman feels more like Austin versus McMahon to me each and every week. And I don't say that as a knock. I say that as a compliment. They're doing Austin versus McMahon as good now with Heyman and Punk as they've ever done before, all the other times they've tried to mimic that feud. You know, especially now, you know, you see Heyman come out on the scooter, just like Vince did back in the day when he had his ankle broke and he came out on the wheelchair. And much like Vince did with Steve Austin back then, you know, Heyman's throwing everything. He's throwing everybody he can to take out Punk. And Punk is doing everything in his power to get his hands on Heyman, and the fans are into it. You know, I'm just waiting for Punk to come out one week on maybe not a beer truck, I guess, maybe like a Pepsi truck or something. It's great. I think what they're doing is great. I thought this segment was really good. The end, not so much. Ryback was supposed to press slam Punk over his head and basically put him through a table. And what ended up happening is he nearly missed most of the table. Actually, he didn't nearly. He did miss most of the table. And Punk took a really bad fall. I thought maybe he was hurt even more, because Punk's all banged up as it is. But apparently he's okay. All Ryback had to do was just press slam him above his head and just dump him through the table. The table was right there, and he missed the mark. And on the subject of Ryback, I saw an item this week that Ryback is under strong consideration to be Undertaker's opponent at next year's WrestleMania, assuming that they can keep him strong, I guess, with Heyman between now and then. And none of this is a lock, but apparently Ryback's name has come up as a potential opponent for The Undertaker. And I just think that's a terrible idea. Undertaker only has so many matches left. You want them to be special. Ryback and Heyman together can be entertaining. I think, you know, Ryback certainly with Heyman is a hell of a lot better off than he was by himself, where he was just floundering and doing nothing. But to me, they killed Ryback a long time ago. He's dead. The only one with a pay-per-view record worse than TNA. And for Christ's sake, he almost killed Punk on a press slam on Monday night. You really want to trust this guy in the ring with The Undertaker in the shape he's probably in? My vote is still for Undertaker versus John Cena. It's a big-time match. You can go for the big false finish where people might actually buy into the idea that Undertaker would lose because it's John Cena. You know, he's the face of the company. Some people may actually believe that Undertaker would put Cena over before he retires, if this is possibly his last match. There's drama there. And the added benefit is that it keeps John Cena out of the WWE Championship match at WrestleMania. I don't need to see Cena wrestling for the title again in the main event. Enough already. Save it for another pay-per-view. Punk and Bryan right now are the two top babyfaces in the promotion. They're very over. People love them. I would love to see them have a chance to wrestle for the title at WrestleMania. But if they want to have Cena return to save the day and wrestle Orton for the title and instead go with a younger guy or one of the newer guys against The Undertaker, I would go with Bray Wyatt over Ryback. Wyatt has way more upside than Ryback does. If the idea is to go with somebody new, I think he'd be a great guy, even if he loses, which I'm sure he would. And it even makes storyline sense, given that it was Bray Wyatt who took out The Undertaker's brother, Kane. I'd be way more intrigued by a Bray Wyatt Undertaker match than a Ryback Undertaker match, and I think the promo work building up to the match itself would probably make for great TV. What's Ryback going to do? Pound his chest? Natalya, the Bellas, and the Funkadactyls, so the entire cast of Total Divas, beat AJ, Oksana, Layla, Alicia Fox, and Tamina Snuka. Where the hell did she come from? I love how they just snuck her in there. Probably didn't even notice that she was in there if you watched this match, because the Divas stopwatch this week had the match at 1 minute 55 seconds. And actually, I think I let the stopwatch go a few seconds fast, so it was more like a minute 52. Now, mind you, they had 10 women out there. This was a 10 Diva tag team match. A complete waste of time, as most of the Divas matches are these days. on a three-hour show, you have 10 women out there. You're pushing this reality show, which is now on a hiatus, but you're still pushing it. And you can't give them 2 minutes of TV time? I thought it was very telling. I saw the ratings breakdowns in the Observer newsletter. This was for the Raw show the week before. And they had that Dusty Rhodes segment with Stephanie McMahon, which I thought was great. And the Dusty segment picked up a whole bunch of people. It picked up like over 800,000 new viewers because people were intrigued to see Dusty Rhodes and what was going to happen with him and the McMahons. People seem to be into this whole Rhodes family storyline because it's been pretty well done so far. And the Total Divas match, they had a Divas match right after the Dusty segment. Now, when you have a big segment like that, generally speaking, even if the guys are out there, it's probably going to lose audience. And the women especially, they tend to not do very well. But you look at these numbers and you see the Dusty segment pick up like 860,000. And the Divas segment immediately afterwards lost over a million. So over a million people, when that segment was over and the Divas came out, said, yeah, I think I'm done here. And they flipped the channel. And I think that's really, really telling as far as how they're pushing the Divas division on television right now. Because I don't buy into the fact that people don't care about Divas wrestling. Okay, maybe not as much as the men, because that's how we're conditioned to think. Women's wrestling, though, I think can draw if you have a compelling storyline. I've mentioned before, Trish and Mickie James, WrestleMania 22 back in 06. I was looking forward to that match more than most of the other matches on the card. I can't remember another time in all the years I've been a fan where I could say that about a Divas match. So don't give me that bullshit line about how nobody cares about the women. You got 3 hours every single week. You've got a bunch of women. You've got some women down in developmental. I would be very sad to see Emma or Paige no longer wrestling on NXT and being relegated to 60-second matches on Raw, but you know what? We need some new blood. Bring them up. Bring up Emma. Bring up Paige. I think either one of them feuding with AJ could be very intriguing. Do something. People just don't care about the Divas because they don't give you a reason to. 10 women out there, a minute 55 seconds. It's just a crock of shit. Cody Rhodes and Goldust were on this show. They actually came out from the crowd before the main event to attack the Shield. People went crazy for him. I thought it was kind of goofy to have Dustin Rhodes out there wearing the Goldust face paint. I know that's how a lot of WWE fans identify him, but if you're trying to pass this off as like a real ambush and these guys just were trying not to be seen, they came out of the crowd, you see this guy wearing his Goldust makeup, I don't know, it just came off as kind of goofy to me. I still thought the angle was good. And security was doing their best to try to drag them out of there. They were being awfully violent with the Rhodes brothers as they dragged them away. So the main event was the Shield, 11-on-3 against the Raw babyfaces, which consisted of Dolph Ziggler, RVD. Yes, RVD was back out there for the main event on the very show where Randy Orton killed him earlier in the night. Did everything that you can imagine to just kill this guy dead. And there's RVD out there with some tape on his ribs, and I think he had a wrap on his elbow. But otherwise, looked perfectly fine. Justin Gabriel was out there. The Usos, Zack Ryder got some time in the Raw main event. Kofi Kingston and the Primetime Players. So those are your baby faces. And RVD was actually the first one eliminated, which I kind of liked in a way just because it was shocking. I don't think you look at that roster, and I don't think anybody expected RVD to go out first. And they had Ambrose pin him with his headlock DDT driver, so RVD was gone. Still a suspect way, I guess, to build up the guy who's wrestling for the world title on pay-per-view in a week. But maybe they want him to sign a new deal. Maybe that's what they want. They want him to sign an extension or a new contract, and he's not doing it. And so this is their way of sending a message. In the meantime, you're trying to promote a title match for pay-per-view that you want people to buy, and nobody gives a shit. So the Shield held their own in this match. They did Ambrose, Reigns. They pinned a whole bunch of guys. The Primetime Players, Zack Ryder got eliminated. There were a lot of things about this match, though, that I liked. Even though the logic behind it was kind of lopsided, didn't really make a lot of sense why Triple H would put the Shield in this predicament. Unless he was just trying to test them. Daniel Bryan put over at the end of this match like he was this big locker room leader. The end of the match was actually really, really good. The crowd was into it. This was a fun match to watch. This was the opposite of that handicap match from Raw back in 08 when they had the 17-on-2 match with Orton and Cena just completely demolishing the entire roster. And that was the biggest difference here. Not everybody in this match necessarily came out looking strong. RVD, for example, I know he got beaten up, but still, he was eliminated first. So you can't really say that he came out looking too good. But what they didn't do here was just completely decimate the entire roster like they did back in 2008. Shield looked strong, even though they lost, and you didn't have to sacrifice all the babyfaces to get the job done. So for that alone, I would call this a success. And the crowd was going nuts at the end, and they were chanting yes, along with Brian. It came down in the end. Brian, I think, took out Rollins with the move that beat John Cena, which that's what I still call it. That's the official title for it. It's the running knee of death to the head. And nobody sells that knee better than Seth Rollins. I just have to put that out there. Dolph Ziggler pinned Dean Ambrose with a zigzag to hype up the match between them on SmackDown Friday night. Even the Usos were made to look strong because they're in line now for a tag team title match. They're the number one contenders for the championship. And when Jey Uso pinned Roman Reigns, they made mention on commentary that that was the first time Roman Reigns has ever been pinned in a WWE ring. So, you know, a good way there to make the Usos actually feel special. After all these months, these guys have been around now almost a full year. Roman Reigns is the muscle, right? He's the heavy of the Shield, and the first person to pin him is one of the Usos. I don't think anybody ever would have predicted that. So this was just a really fun main event. A fun way to end the show. Next week, Los Matadores make their debut. Primo and Epico are back. I don't know if they're going to call them Primo and Epico or if they're just going to pretend like they don't know who they are because half their face is covered by a mask, even though everybody could probably easily tell who it is. I guess we'll find out. I had also heard that I think it was Mascarita Dorada, the midget wrestler, the mini from Mexico, was going to be part of their group. It was going to be like a three-person act. I haven't seen any signs of any minis in the commercials, so I don't know if they abandoned that idea. But I was of the impression that they would have a midget mascot as part of their act. I guess we'll see on Monday night if he's there. And they're also hyping that Triple H has invited the Rhodes family, Cody, Dusty, and Dustin, to attend Raw Monday night, and there will be some sort of, I guess, business proposal. We've heard this before. I assume it's a six-person tag team match. I had one person write into me, and I forgive me for forgetting the person's name, but he was wondering if perhaps Dolph Ziggler may substitute for Dusty Rhodes to be part of that match, because Dolph Ziggler has had his issues with the Shield. He has no match on pay-per-view, unless they announce something Friday night. I haven't seen all of SmackDown yet. Even if they do that, it probably would be a last-minute substitution at the pay-per-view. You got a week until the show. They're first going to announce this match on Monday night. Unless they do it on the same show, it's going to be, I'm guessing, Dusty, Dustin, and Cody. And Dusty probably will just stand out on the apron, and maybe he'll throw a bionic elbow. But he can't really do much more than that. You know, the guy's almost 70 years old. I think he's getting ready to have a knee replacement operation soon. Even when Big Show knocked him out a few weeks ago, he couldn't even fall down to take a bump. Big Show had to hold him. So I wouldn't expect Dusty to do much in that match. And I also want to go back to Dolph Ziggler for a second, because there was an item in the Observer newsletter this week that got a lot of play, and it concerns why Dolph Ziggler has effectively been buried. There's no other word for it, and I hate using that word, because I think that's one of the most overused words on all the internet when it comes to wrestling, is buried. But you really can't call it anything else with Dolph Ziggler. The guy's been buried 6 feet under over the last month or two. And basically in the item, it mentioned that the belief among those behind the scenes, i.e. Vince McMahon, is that Dolph Ziggler will never be a guy who draws money. And so now he's in this awful position of being buried every week on television, losing not all of his matches, but losing a lot of matches that he had no business losing. I mean, here's a guy who was the world champion. He was the most over guy on the roster. You go back to that Raw the night after WrestleMania, and now you look at him all these months later, and it's almost like you can't even imagine it's the same guy. But it is. And I'm sure it must be affecting him. It can't make him feel good to go out there every week and just be a bit player, you know, in the mid-card. So it fucks with your head. he still goes out there and he bumps like a maniac and he has good matches. So it's not like Zack Ryder, who I feel like Zack Ryder, it was obvious after a while that this guy was just completely demoralized. He stopped spiking his hair. He stopped tanning. He was showing up looking all pale and pasty. It was almost like the guy just didn't give a shit. And I haven't really gotten that sense from Ziggler, but I wouldn't blame the guy if he felt that way. And what's interesting about this is I totally believe that this is true. I don't look at this and go, oh, it's just, you know, internet bullshit. If you remember a few months ago, Shawn Michaels did an interview. I don't remember what radio station it was with. But he did an interview, and he mentioned a conversation that he had just had with Vince McMahon. And it was almost like the two of them were arguing. Because I guess Vince had made a comment to Shawn about somebody on the roster who he didn't think had the ability to draw money. And Shawn was trying to stick up for this guy and defend him and say, hey, listen, you said that once upon a time about me. I was some small guy on the roster who you probably didn't think can draw money, and look at me. And so everybody automatically jumped to conclusions and thought that he was talking about Daniel Bryan. Because Shawn trained Bryan. Bryan was starting to get a big push, but he's a small guy. And perhaps Vince didn't think that Bryan could draw money. And Shawn actually had to come out on Twitter and say, listen, I can tell you that the guy that I was talking about was not Daniel Bryan. So the story comes straight from Shawn Michaels' mouth. That's a real conversation that he had with Vince. He said it wasn't about Bryan. Now we're hearing this stuff about how Ziggler's not getting pushed because they don't think he can draw money. Which leads one to believe that the person Shawn was probably talking about that time was Dolph Ziggler. Now the question is he right? Can Dolph Ziggler draw money or not? Or is he just an undercard guy for the rest of his career? I see no reason why Dolph Ziggler can't draw money and people will buy tickets to see him and all that kind of stuff. But do I see him being a top guy? And I say this as a fan of Dolph Ziggler. I enjoy watching him work. I think he's a great performer. He's very entertaining to watch. Do I see Dolph Ziggler being a top guy? The way that Cena's a top guy. Orton's a top guy. The way that CM Punk is a top guy. Honestly, no. I don't. And it's not that he can't, you know, back it up in the ring. I think he's a great wrestler, but I don't know. There's something about the guy where I don't look at him that way. I look at Ziggler either as a babyface or a heel. He could be like an upper mid-card, low-end main eventer who feuds with whoever the top babyface is. If let's say he's a heel. I hesitate to compare him. I talked about Triple H last week and how Jim Cornette once said that Triple H is the guy who feuds with the guy. And I hate to use that same analogy. I kind of look at Dolph Ziggler the same way. And I'm not quite sure why. I don't know if that's just because it's the way he's been booked. It's clouded my judgment now. And now I don't look at him as a main event guy. Or if that's just how I honestly feel about it. But you ask me that question right now, that's my answer. I don't know that he is a top guy, but I think he can draw money. It's just that if you don't push the guy and he starts losing every single match, it's one of those self-fulfilling prophecies where, oh, you see, he can't draw. Well, yeah, he can't draw because you're not giving him the opportunity to draw. You're beating him like a drum. If you actually push him a little bit and give the guy some momentum, get him back in that world title picture. I mean, it's not like that title means anything anyway. I don't see what harm there is in putting him back in the world title picture, putting the belt back on him. He never really got a fair shake. He got kicked in the head by Jack Swagger, and it's not his fault. Shit happens. So he kind of got the shaft when it came to his title run earlier this year. Put the title back on him, and he'll be, you know, the secondary world champion underneath whatever Bryan's doing with Orton, and give him a run with somebody, and let's see how he does. I mean, what do you guys think? Do you look at Dolph Ziggler and think to yourself, this guy could be the number one guy or the number two guy in the company, like Shawn Michaels used to be, or even in the position that Bryan is in right now? Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm crazy. And everybody else thinks that Dolph Ziggler could easily be the top guy. I don't see it right now. I'd be curious to know what you guys think, if you agree or disagree on that. Quick Jim Ross update here. I listened to JR on the Steve Austin show, which was a good interview. You should check it out. I was most interested to see how this retirement sham was addressed. And as I figured, they didn't really address any of it. I didn't think they would. Austin brought up the retirement, how it caught him way off guard. He didn't see it coming. And Ross just reiterated what he said on his website, that he's not ready for the rocking chair yet. We'll be seeing him doing other things in the near future. I actually was expecting JR to mock all of the internet reports and deny it and give the usual line about how we shouldn't believe everything we read on the internet. He didn't even do that, which I thought was the most telling thing of all. Just as telling as WWE completely ignoring the whole thing on TV. Not one mention of Jim Ross at all. So, there's your answer as far as how legitimate this retirement stuff is. NXT, this past week, this was the start of a new batch of tapings. Pretty noteworthy show. It opened with the Raw general manager, Brad Maddox. Tyler Breeze and CJ Parker, they both want in the tag team turmoil match on the show this week, but they have no partner. So Maddox makes them an unwilling tag team. Tyler Breeze says, anybody but him. I'll team with anybody but this guy. I'll even clone myself. And unfortunately, he was not able to do that. Tag team turmoil was Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy starting out against Tyler Breeze and CJ Parker. Breeze and Parker, not exactly the best team. They were on the losing end of this match. Breeze never even got to tag into the match. Went about 90 seconds. When Tyler Breeze finally demanded the tag, CJ Parker turned around into a Uranage slam from Colin Cassidy and got pinned. And Breeze left in disgust. Next up, Scott Dawson and Alexander Rusev, Sylvester LaForte's odd couple tag team. They didn't last long either. After Scott Dawson nailed the spinebuster on Enzo Amore, and Amore immediately rolled him up in a small package for the pin. Dawson and Rusev beat the crap out of Enzo and Cassidy for good measure when the match was over, just to soften them up. Or is it soft? Is that how it is? That's how he says it, right? Soften? Should I say it like that? I don't sound good when I say that. I don't even have a New York accent, let alone a New Jersey accent. People can't believe when I tell them I lived in Brooklyn, grew up in Brooklyn, and still live in Brooklyn. They look at me like I have to be lying to them because I don't have the New York accent. I had a radio person once tell me that it was actually a blessing. This was when I was attempting to get into radio. They said, you know what? The fact that you don't have a New York accent will actually work to your advantage. I think there's a lot of truth to that. The Ascension came out. They were the final tag team. I think you can pretty much figure out what happened here. They didn't beat them right away, but didn't go much longer, this tag team turmoil match here. The Ascension got the win with their total elimination finish. The old Eliminators move from ECW. Although when the Eliminators used to do it, when Saturn and Cronus did it, it was a lot more devastating than when the Ascension does it. They need to put a little more oomph, I think, behind the move to make it more devastating. So the Ascension now are the number one contenders for the NXT Tag Team titles. They, at some point, will meet Corey Graves and Adrian Neville. Sasha Banks beat Bayley. Sasha now has Summer Rae in her corner. Summer has corrupted this poor girl. Bayley is super over as this geeky girl next door type. It was a losing effort for her here. Sasha won with her handcuff neck breaker maneuver. I don't think it has a name yet. If it does, the announcers did not bother telling us. By the way, how can I forget? They had Renee Young join William Regal and Tom Phillips on commentary for this match. She was good. I didn't really get to hear a lot of her on this show. She was only out there for this one match, so I'm not sure if the future tapings have her doing more commentary with Regal or if it was just a one-off. I was of the impression that she got a shot to do play-by-play with Regal for all the matches, including the men's. That wasn't the case here on this show. But from what I heard, she was fine. You know, I didn't, again, I can't make a determination of how good she is yet. But I can say she didn't distract from the match and she wasn't annoying like Tony Dawson was. Tony Dawson, for those who don't know, was released by WWE last week. He was the guy that JBL and Michael Cole used to pick on the Cole and JBL radio show. It's no great surprise. I said this before. He just really wasn't that good. Regal did call Tom Tony once on this show, but he quickly corrected himself. After the match, Summer Rae cut a promo announcing that next week, her man Fandango, or is it Fandango, will be appearing with her on NXT. She also said that she and her girl Sasha, who she referred to as the boss, boss of what? I don't know. She says the two of them are now the dominant divas on NXT since they got rid of Paige and Emma. So cue Emma, who sprints down to the ring, the heels bail. Later backstage, Renee Young catches up with Summer, who issues a tag team challenge for next week, herself and Sasha, against Emma and a partner of her choosing. Gee, I wonder who that will be. She also referred to Fandango as her baby boopsie. I promise to not ever refer to him by that name on this show. You have my word. Aiden English graced us with an encore presentation. Encore performance from last week, this time singing a different song on his way to the ring. The dude's a really good singer. Not for nothing. I don't know if that's if he's supposed to be bad, but it's part of the gimmick, or if he's actually really supposed to be good, but he sings these songs, and he sounds like a real professional singer. And the crowd applauds very loudly when he's done, even though he's a heel, I think. I shouldn't say that. I mean, they haven't really established what he is, but he kind of acts in this pompous way where you almost want to boo him, but he's so good when he sings that you just can't. So I don't know what the hell he's supposed to be. He beat Bull Dempsey, who was treated like a jobber here, but that's actually a pretty cool name, Bull Dempsey. I'd like to see more of him. After the match with the crowd chanting encore, he gives it to them and sings again. And you see, now if he were a true heel, and if they let these guys call an audible with stuff like that, he'd hear those crowd chants and pick up the mic, go to sing, and then tell them they're not a worthy audience, drop the mic, and leave. I'm entertained by guys like him and Tyler Breeze, but there is a shocking lack of real heels in wrestling these days. You know, when Edge first went heel, I remember him saying it was his goal to make himself the most hated person on the entire show, with absolutely no redeeming qualities whatsoever, because he didn't want the fans to cheer for him. Chris Jericho, he talks about being a heel and not signing autographs for kids at the arenas because he didn't want them thinking he was a real swell guy, you know, when they went to sit down in their seats for the show. He wanted to be hated. He wouldn't even let WWE make any t-shirts or Chris Jericho merchandise because he didn't want people wearing it. He sacrificed money to make the gimmick work. Those two, and probably CM Punk, I think, are the only real heels I could think of in WWE in the last 5 or 6 years. I mean, real heels. Sami Zayn beat El Local, the masked luchador, who looks an awful lot like Ricardo Rodriguez with what little bit of his face is exposed. And he sounds a lot like Ricardo as well when he mocks his opponent. I'll be honest, he was moving around great in the ring. I think if they wanted to bring El Local, to bring that gimmick to TV, and let Ricardo do his thing under the mask, he'd fit in just fine. He didn't look out of place at all. He's a fine worker. The stuff he's doing now with RVD is a complete waste of his talent. It does nothing to help RVD. They have no chemistry together at all. I have more chemistry with my last three ex-girlfriends than RVD has with Ricardo Rodriguez. And they're both great, just not together. It's just not working. You know, so anyway, Sami Zayn and El Local, one well-placed Yakuza kick to the face in the corner is all it took. Sami Zayn got the pin. Pretty good little match for all of the 3 minutes they were given here. Afterwards, out comes NXT champion Bo Dallas to congratulate Sami on his big win. He's got big news as he announces the Bo Dallas Invitational, where any NXT star is invited to step up and face the champion. If they can beat him, they get a title shot. Unfortunately for Sami Zayn, he is not eligible to compete in this invitational. Bo Dallas is trying to teach Sami Zayn some respect. And he wants Sami Zayn to earn himself a title match. Well, I guess sleeping with the boss's daughter is out, so Sami's going to have to find some other way. To the back, with Brad Maddox on the phone, suddenly he is interrupted by the returning Cassius Ohno. Back from the gym! He wants to know why he's been kept off TV since he's been medically cleared after being attacked by the Wyatt family a few months ago. Maddox says that Ohno is just a D+, maybe a C-. Then he changes his mind and says, nope, you're a D+. And they just haven't had a need for him. So that's nice. Maddox agrees to give Ohno a match next week against a member of the Wyatt family. And minor spoiler, I think it turns out to be Luke Harper. I won't say what happens, but it's good to see Cassius Ohno back, at least. I thought he was, you read all these reports, he was one step away from being cut. I couldn't tell if physically he looked any different because he was wearing a jacket or something. I guess we'll see next week. Finally, it's time for the COO of WWE to make his big announcement. Yes, as if a Triple H promo on pay-per-view this month was not enough, we now get one on NXT as well. I wonder what other places Triple H can show up and cut promos in. You know, perhaps his local Whole Foods when he goes grocery shopping. Just get on the PA system and cut a promo about their prices, how their prices are not best for business, which is actually true. I went into Whole Foods once and I was appalled by their prices. I don't care how fresh and organic everything is. Whole Foods my ass. So Triple H brought up the Rhodes family stuff that's been going on. He said to give Dusty Rhodes a chance to deal with all of that, he's going to give him some time off as the GM of NXT. And he is replacing him with an interim acting general manager who turns out to be John Bradshaw Layfield. Yes, JBL, the new GM of NXT, he comes out. And like a real heel, he tells the crowd that this isn't sing-along with the wrestling god after they started to chant his name. And he said, JBL as NXT GM knows what's best for business. So a pretty good little edition of NXT. It's just, again, it's an easy watch every week. You get some good wrestling. It's fun to see some of these guys develop. Sami Zayn has the potential to be a big star on the main roster. He can work with almost anybody. He's a Daniel Bryan caliber guy who can go in there. You're almost guaranteed to get a good match. He's actually, if you know what, I will say this. From what I've seen, I would almost say that Sami Zayn is even better on the mic than Daniel Bryan is. And Bryan's not terrible on the mic, but just Sami Zayn has this natural, articulate speaking ability, which is hilarious to me because for all those years he wore a mask on his face and people were so upset when he came to NXT. You know, he can't be El Generico anymore. They're going to take the mask off him. They gave him this awful name, Sami Zayn. What does that even mean? And what we have found is very similar with Alberto Del Rio, who wore a mask in Mexico for many years. With some of these guys, when you take the mask off, it just opens up this whole new world of possibilities for them. And for Alberto Del Rio, at the beginning when he was a heel, he would do that wink. And you know, you can't do that if you're wearing a mask. Or it's very hard to do that if you have a mask on. Sami Zayn, you know, he wouldn't speak English when he was El Generico. Meanwhile, in real life, the guy knows like five or six different languages. It's kind of a waste, if you think about it. So, again, NXT is free on Hulu, those of you who still are not aware. So you can check it out there. Let's shift over to TNA, Impact Wrestling, which was live from Little Rock, Arkansas, this past week. I'm going to give a quick run-through of the show here, just some of the more important things that I jotted down. We had more Aces and Eights dissension as the group continues to crumble. We had Nux speaking up for them against Bully. So Nux has taken on the role, I guess. I mean, there's only, at the beginning of the show, there were really only three other guys left in Aces and Eights. He has taken over the role as being kind of the spokesman for the group, spokesman for the younger guys. And it's too bad for Nux that this storyline is ending because he's doing the best promo work of his career right now. Bully told all of them to fall in line. They're being insubordinate. And he announced that, you know, they have a match later in the show against the Main Event Mafia. It was going to be Nux, Briscoe, and Bischoff against Sting, Joe, and Magnus. And if any of them lose the match, the man who takes the losing fall is going to be gone from Aces and Eights. So that's what we got at the beginning of the show there. There was a segment before the ODB, Eric Young, Joe Park six-man that I thought was kind of clever. It was Joe Park in the back, in the bathroom, in the mirror. He was attempting to shave. He was about to shave. And Eric Young saw this, and he stopped him. He said, whoa, 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 what are you doing here? He said, we can't run the risk of you cutting yourself while you shave. If you cut yourself and you bleed, you're liable to morph into this monster, and there's no telling what you'll do to the people backstage. You're a menace. So I thought that was kind of clever. I guess that's the gimmick now. They have to do everything they can to make sure that Joe Park doesn't bleed, which I guess means if TNA has any real meaningful drug testing, that they can't drug test Joe Park. I mean, I guess he could take a piss test, but they can't take blood. ODB, Eric Young, and Joe Park beat the Bromans and Gail Kim when all the baby faces hit their finish on Jesse Godders. ODB actually got the pin. This was total comedy here. He had an Austin Aries promo. This actually was the best thing on the entire show. Aries came out to cut a promo, talking about himself, how great he is. That's what Austin Aries does. He got interrupted by Kenny King. All I could think of when I saw Kenny King, I forgot Kenny King was even employed by TNA anymore. I can't remember the last time I saw him on Impact. I guess he's one of those guys that they cycle out every few weeks because they can't afford to pay him to fly in for the shows if he's not going to do anything. So it was good to see Kenny King back. I thought Kenny King cut probably the best promo I've ever seen him cut. It was a long promo, and I thought he did a hell of a job. I've never seen Kenny King cut such a long promo in my entire life. And unlike Hulk Hogan later on in the show, who only had a few lines, Kenny King didn't stumble over his words. But then again, Kenny King is 20-something years old. Hulk Hogan is 60. Probably forgot what he had for breakfast yesterday. So I guess that explains that. But they ended up having a match. King got busted open hard way. I think it was, they mentioned that, I guess he cut his head open on the steel steps. I don't think they showed that on TV. I think it came during the commercial break, because I went back and rewound it when they mentioned that. I didn't see anything. So he got busted open hard way, and it was good to see color in this match. And by that, I don't mean Kenny King. I mean blood, because we don't get to see it a lot anymore. Even in TNA, I'm not aware of any sort of blood ban in TNA or some sort of edict like they have in WWE. But we don't see blood very often anymore, which is probably for the better. But when we do, I think it's more impactful. If I had one criticism about that, it's this. And it's a minor criticism, but when Kenny King got busted open, his face was just completely filled with blood at one point. And you would never even know that the guy was cut open if you didn't see the blood. Like, he was just sauntering around like he always does, wasn't selling it at all. He wasn't woozy or wobbly or anything like that. He did a pretty piss-poor job, I thought, of actually selling that, even if that wasn't supposed to be part of the match. That would be my only criticism. Otherwise, this is the best match in the entire show. I thought they had a really good match. Hopefully, Kenny King doesn't just vanish into thin air for another 5 months. This was good stuff, and Aries got the win in the end with the Brainbuster. They had a promo advertising that Lady Tapa is coming. I think she's is she the daughter of the Barbarian? I think she's the daughter of the Barbarian. She was the one who was on Gut Check that time, and we have not heard from her since. She's been down in, I think, OVW. And Lady Tapa is coming is what the promo said, and she can't come soon enough. If she waits any longer, there won't be a knockouts division left for her to compete in. So I don't know if that means she'll be on the show next week or like these Los Matadores promos, if they're just going to run them for weeks on end, but she's on her way. Also on their way, let me skip ahead a little bit here, they aired a mysterious vignette telling us that Ethan is coming. No idea who Ethan is, but God knows they need some new talent on this roster with all the guys. They're thinning out the herd in TNA between people leaving and people getting released. I haven't done a head count to see how many people are left on that roster, but it can't be that many. So any new fresh talent that they can bring in is for the better. Backstage, Magnus was pissed off with the Extraordinary Gentlemen's Organization, Ego, the combination of Bobby Roode, Chris Daniels, and Frankie Kazarian. Has not been a good few weeks for poor Magnus. Samoa Joe and Sting told him not to let them get in his head. Chin up. One of our listeners, Christopher, wrote in with an interesting idea. I'll actually read it here. This is what he says. With TNA's pattern of ripping off WWE, do you see them doing an angle where Magnus turns heel, winning the world title from AJ Styles, becoming Dixie's corporate champion? Before she turned heel, the announcers would always say how Dixie views Magnus as the future of the company. What do you think? And to that, I could definitely see that happening. Styles beats Bully Ray at Bound for Glory, and especially if Styles ends up leaving TNA at the end of the year, they could do a deal where Magnus goes heel and beats him for the belt as Dixie's hand-picked champion. It'd be a good thing for Magnus. It'd be a big boost for his career, I guess. But just such a blatant ripoff of what WWE is doing right now. I guess they're already copying one of their angles, so why not go all the way with it? I imagine this stuff with Magnus is building to something, and maybe that's it. They hyped Kurt Angle returning to Bound for Glory, so it looks like his Hall of Fame induction is still a go. I hope Kurt's got his shit together. I really do. I think the dude probably needs a good 6 months away from wrestling. I don't know that 2 months is enough time, but it's his life. Manic beat Chris Sabin to retain his X Division title. Sabin tried to use Velvet Sky as a human shield in the ring and then cradled Manic, but Manic reversed it and got the pin. Sabin attacked him after the match, but Austin Aries came out, made the save. Sabin's mannerisms remind me a lot of Brian Pillman when he was doing the loose cannon gimmick. I don't think he could make it work the way Pillman did, but I like Sabin more now than I did when he was champion, so that's something at least. Velvet looked appalled by all of this, by the way, so she has not yet gone fully heel. Main Event Mafia beat the Aces and Eights after Samoa Joe got Wes Briscoe to tap out in the Coquina Clutch during the match. Ego came out and attacked Magnus. He injured his knee in the process, had to be carried to the back, which left Sting and Joe all by themselves, and they still won. Isn't that the story of Aces and Eights from the very beginning, from day one, how neutered they were? You know, they weren't even made to look strong at the beginning. at least at the beginning, you would think, okay, they're going to win most of their matches. They're going to look devastating and brutal. They were a fucking joke from day one. And now here at the end, it's they've come full circle because they're as much of a joke now as they were at the beginning. Briscoe is out of Aces and Eights. If I were him, I'd throw a friggin' party. I'd celebrate. Bully Ray came out, told Bischoff and Nux to get Briscoe's cut, his vest, take it away from him. They refused, so Bully beat up Briscoe all by himself. He gave him a pile driver. Finally, he demanded they remove Briscoe's cut and hand it over to him, which they reluctantly did. It's funny to me that Taz will be the last remaining member of Aces and Eights with Bully Ray when this is over, because nobody is allowed to touch Taz, and he doesn't take any bumps. So I wonder if after everyone else is gone, if one day he'll just stand up at the announce desk and just calmly remove his vest, stick it in a garbage can, and sit back down and pretend like none of this ever happened. You know, like, Aces and what? What are you talking about? I don't know what that is. Hulk Hogan was out. He was only semi-coherent here. He's stumbling all over himself. He brought out AJ Styles. Hogan did what Hogan does best. He told Styles how great he was, how he's going to be the next TNA champion. Remember a year ago when Hogan stood in the ring and told Austin Aries with a straight face that he was the greatest wrestler he had ever seen or some shit like that? Yeah, fun times. He said he had a new contract that he wanted AJ Styles to sign, and that would keep him with TNA. Why Styles would do such a thing after talking about all the leverage he'll have over Dixie Carter after he wins the title of Bound for Glory and how he's going to make her pay top dollar for him, why he would then sign this contract now, I have no idea. It would seem like a bad business move on his part, but he signed the contract anyway. He told Hogan, I'm yours. At that point, out came heel Dixie, who said that Hogan is just an employee. She says Hulk may see value in the phenomenally marginal one, but she does not, and she ripped up the contract that AJ Styles just signed. And then she ordered him to the back so the adults can play in the ring. Seriously, Styles just walked away and was never heard from again. He did tell Dixie that you just made the biggest mistake of your life. Dixie the whole time was like with her a flick of her wrist, like shooing him away, like, okay, little boy, okay, you can go to the back now, let the adults play. If they're going to copy the Daniel Bryan storyline, the least they could do is have some of Dixie's goons come out and lay him out first. At least that would make it more genuine. Dixie then launched into this promo about people can't relate to her because they've never had to live in her world. She talked about all the criticism she gets and all the nasty tweets, which is something I said they have to play off of because it's what feeds her heel character. So I was actually very happy to hear her bring that up. She said it's the 1% that creates the world they get to live in while she has to suffer the burden. And she told Hogan he has a decision to make, either get on Team Dixie or join AJ Styles and watch from the sidelines. She gave him 1 week to decide, and then she walked off. It's week two of the Dixie heel turn, so it's still too early to say whether or not this is actually going to be any sort of success or not. I cringed a lot during this promo. She had her moments. I thought it was very good that they brought up all the criticism she's gotten in the tweets and everything else. Like I said, you have to. You have to play off of that. It has to bother her on some level, and so she needs to channel all that into this promo. But, I mean, man, there were moments during this thing that just made me bury my head in my hands. She was really not that good. She would have flickers of hope here and there. I thought the one line that kind of made me laugh was when she mentioned AJ saying, you know, how she was going to have Dixie on her knees, and Dixie was like, I don't know what you're thinking of, but in your dreams, I thought that was a good line. But it still seems just way too forced to me. You know, when she told AJ to leave, she was speaking all calmly, and then out of nowhere, she's just like, you know, get out of here, get out of here, and she's screaming, and it just seemed completely unnatural to me. So she's got some work to do as far as that goes. So all in all, I can't sit here and knock the promo too much. It wasn't good, but it wasn't that bad. I guess that's the best thing I could say about it. But then I went and I read the spoilers for next week's edition of Impact, the show that will air this upcoming Thursday. So this is a spoiler alert. I'm just putting you all on notice now. If you don't want to know what happens on Impact this week, turn it off. On next week's Impact, Dixie Carter brings out Vince McMahon, who announces that he... I'm sorry. Those are the spoilers for the March 20th show next year. My bad. Here we go, the October 3rd episode. So Hulk Hogan has to make his decision. Is he on Team Dixie, Or is he going to side with AJ Styles and be part of the problem instead of being part of the solution? And they shot an angle where Hogan decides to quit. He quits TNA out of disgust. And in response to Hulk Hogan quitting on television, Dixie Carter, right, the heel president of TNA, she's all confident and cocky. And, you know, we've seen Dixie over the last 2 weeks. She doesn't seem timid or anything like that. It's like she's coming out of her shell. Dixie Carter gets down on her knees, like AJ Styles said she would, and wraps herself, physically wraps herself, around Hulk Hogan's leg, begging him not to go. Now, think about this. This was done because Hogan's contract in real life is expiring on October 1st. So, unless they've already secretly reached a new deal to keep Hogan around, and now they're trying to swerve everybody, and it's going to be part of the ongoing storyline, okay? There's no indication of that yet. Hogan's contract is coming up, and this is probably going to be his exit from TNA if they can't reach a new deal. So this appearance on Thursday night could very well be the last time we see Hogan on TNA television. I don't think it will be, but it could be. And this is how they scripted his storyline exit. That he takes it upon himself to quit TNA, not have Dixie Carter get more heat by firing him. He quits on his own, and Dixie wraps herself around his leg and just begs him not to go and tries to prevent him from leaving. And then apparently freaks out to end the show. PW Insider, one of the many websites who has gotten questions from people asking, why would they do this? And their response was very simple. They heard from people in TNA who had this one answer. Creative control. Hogan, everywhere he's gone, even when he went back to WWE 6 or 7 years ago, had a creative control clause in his contract. It's why he beat Shawn Michaels. It's why he beat Randy Orton. Why you would give 100% creative control to anybody is beyond me. You must really want them badly. And I guess Hogan knows that, and he's smart enough to know that TNA wanted him. He got the creative control he asked for. And it's because of situations just like the one that we're going to see on Thursday night. And the guy is brilliant. I give him all the credit in the world. I mean, if I could get 100% creative control in his position, I would do that too. So I know that nobody can ever fuck with me. So that Vince McMahon can never make me look bad in my hometown and embarrass me like he embarrassed so many other people. I don't fault Hogan for it. I fault TNA for it. The idea that this could be it, this could be Hogan's swan song, and the final appearance is the owner, the president of the company, on her hands and knees begging this guy not to leave as he walks out, is so fucking hilarious to me. And I think it's just such a great metaphor for TNA. It's TNA in a fucking nutshell. It's just amazing. It really is amazing to think that unless this is all part of an angle and they reached a deal and Hogan is going to stay, that this could be it for this guy, which will be good for TNA in the long run. I'm not saying that they're wrong for letting him walk. What I'm saying is the idea that they can't even use his exit to their advantage. They can't even do that right. Even if their hands are tied because of the whole creative control thing, they put themselves in this position. They booked this storyline. It's their fault. And to think that you're going to have the image of the president of this company basically doing what Stephanie McMahon did the night after the invasion. When that whole invasion storyline came to an end and Team WWF won, I think it was the next night on Raw when Stephanie came out and she wanted to, you know, stay in the company, get her old job back, and she tried to, you know, be all nice to her father. And Vince basically said to security, get her out of my ring, and she wrapped herself around Vince's leg and they had to drag her away. That was how the character was supposed to be portrayed. And it almost, reading these results for Thursday's show, sounds like Dixie Carter is going to be doing the exact same thing. Only this time, this is a hell of a lot more real than that invasion storyline was. So I think that if they ever write the book on the end of TNA, okay, the death of TNA, I think that that would make for a perfect cover to the book. Just an image of Dixie Carter on her hands and knees, wrapped around Hulk Hogan's leg, as he's facing the exit door. Mailbag time. If you have questions, as always, you can email them to me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. That goes for audio questions as well. We are accepting them. MP3 format only. Please keep them brief, preferably no more than 30 seconds or so. and include the question in written form in the body of the email as well, or else it will likely not be used on the air. This week's audio question comes to us from Rayvon Adamson.
Hi, Solid Monster. This is Rayvon Adamson. What was the main reason MVP got released from WWE back in 2010? And do you think that you will ever see him in the WWE ring again? And how do you think they will book him?
What was the main reason that MVP was released in 2010? He had a year left on his contract, and he was dodging John Laurinaitis backstage left and right. You know, Johnny Ace kept coming up to him, pestering him about signing a new deal. They, unlike TNA, they don't like waiting until the last minute to sign guys to new deals. So even though he had a year left, they wanted him to sign something new. And he just wasn't happy. He didn't feel he was being used right. He wanted to pursue his dream of wrestling in Japan, which he ended up doing for New Japan Pro Wrestling. He actually has had complimentary things to say about Johnny Ace because Johnny Ace worked for many years in Japan, and he felt that he could relate to MVP wanting to go over there and work, and they granted him his release, which they don't do very often. I'm sure that part of that release was contingent on him not going to TNA, but he went to Japan, had some success there. I could see him back in WWE one day, assuming that nobody in WWE saw or heard the comments he made during the Iron Sheik roast over the WrestleMania weekend festivities, which was actually very entertaining. I thought MVP was one of the better roasters that night. And it was a roast, but boy, he had some pretty brutal things to say about the company at that roast. But I think we could see him back there one day. As far as how they would use him, probably not all that different from the way they're using Rob Van Dam right now. You know, using him as a former star to fill some upper mid-card feuds and help put over the newer guys. I don't see him winning the world title or anything like that, but I think he could be a solid addition to the roster if they wanted to bring him back. Ramey writes in all the way from Morocco. I wanted to ask you if you think that this Los Matadores gimmick they are giving to Primo and Epico will go somewhere. My answer is hell no. I believe it'll be at best like Fandango or the Funkasaurus. It may get some reaction the first few weeks, and then they'll end up just like everybody else. Also, I don't see how we are supposed to believe that Primo and Epico went away for many months and came back as professional Spanish bullfighters. And for a company that's so butthurt about being politically correct and child-friendly, choosing a gimmick that represents a vulgar and heinous crime where silly-dressed men torture and kill a bull for narrow-minded people's amusement is simply a moronic choice. It amazes me that WWE would think this is okay. And at the same time, if one of their employees was caught kicking a frog, he would be fired in an instant and an apology would be posted on WWE.com. Hypocrisy at its best. Finally, why do you call Kevin Nash lucky sperm? That always makes me laugh. Well, I wasn't expecting that second question. That kind of came out of nowhere. But the lucky sperm reference for Nash comes from a rant I went on after he made some very disparaging, I felt, comments about Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero. More so Eddie Guerrero being vanilla midgets. And this was just in the last couple of years. My point was, Nash has had a very blessed career, largely because of his size. He is very tall. And if you are very tall in wrestling, especially back when he became a star, that works to your advantage. It was something that he was born into and not something that he had control over. You know, Benoit and Eddie and Jericho and those guys, they got over in spite of being a lot smaller than most wrestlers were. So, in effect, Kevin Nash is the product of lucky sperm, which is why I call him Lucky Sperm Nash. As far as your original question, you know, the act of bullfighting, I mean, I don't want to get political here. People will feel the way they feel about it. It's kind of like people who don't like hunting because you're harming animals. Yeah, there are people who hunt for food. Like Shawn Michaels has talked about this. When he hunts, and I don't know if this is different now because he has the TV show, but I know before the TV show, he would talk about it and say, listen, everything that I hunt, I eat, and my family eats. Now, that may not be enough for some people. You still say, oh, well, why do you hunt? You know, you can go to the store and buy food, whatever. Again, I'm not going to get into that whole thing. Is it barbaric and stupid? It's pretty stupid, okay? I think we could all admit the idea that these guys are going to... I think of the running of the bulls in Pamplona. I don't know if I have any Spanish listeners here, and perhaps they may feel differently about this, but from the outside looking in, you look at something like the running of the bulls, which is one of the dumbest fucking things I think I've ever seen, and I see these guys get injured and they get gored, and it's like, oh my God, that's so terrible. I don't look at it that way. I look at it as natural selection. You know, we're weeding out the dumb shits in society. If you want to go ahead and put yourself in that position where, you know, you're provoking these bulls and now they're running after you and you've got to run away to save your life and you get gored, good. That's what you deserve. That's how I feel about it. I just think it's dumb. But it's tradition. And it means something to other people. We can agree to disagree on that. I would be more offended if I were Mexican portraying these guys as bullfighters when I don't even think they have bullfighting in Mexico. I mean, maybe they do. I know it's most associated with Spain. It's a Spanish thing, not a Mexican thing. I guess their logic is, well, they're Latin, so it's all the same. You know, Yokozuna is Samoan, so what? Stick a diaper on him and have him eat a giant bowl of rice, and we'll call him Japanese, and people won't know the difference. And you're right, I see it as more of a gimmick deal like a Funkasaurus or a Fandango, but these guys get on TV almost every week, right? Fandango and Funkasaurus, they may not be in high-profile matches, but they're on TV most weeks. If it helps get Primo and Epico some TV time, then I say fine, whatever works. They've been wasted for far too long. Kenny Givens from Cincinnati, Ohio. It seems as if WWE is bringing The Miz back into the main event. How would you feel if they turned him heel and feuded him with Daniel Bryan? I mean, the guy did main event WrestleMania because he was the best heel of the current era. Oh, no, 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 no. You did not just say that. Actually, he headlined WrestleMania so that they could have a warm body in there to beat Cena when Rock laid him out with a rock bottom. That main event was more about Rock versus Cena than it was Miz versus Cena. You could have put anybody in that spot, and it would not have mattered. That was the single worst main event in WrestleMania history. Just the shits that match was. And if Rock were not advertised as being on that show, with that as your main event, that show would have done terrible business. Okay, all the build-up to WrestleMania made it seem like we were guaranteed to get a confrontation between Rock and Cena. And they did it that way on purpose. And if Miz was the best heel of this era, he'd still be the champion. Or at least he'd still be hovering in the main event. Up until a month ago, he was stuck in feuds with Fandango and Curtis Axel. And before that, I don't even think he was on TV for months. And while I'm on the subject, let me just clarify something, because I get questions a lot asking, why do you hate The Miz? What's your beef with The Miz? I have no beef with The Miz. I just think, as a babyface, he sucks. He's completely miscast. How would I feel if they turned him heel to feud with Bryan? I'd be happy to see him go heel again, because I think he's naturally very hateable. That's how he comes across to me on TV. When I see him, I want to see the dude get punched in the face. I wouldn't pay to see him get punched in the face, which is the difference between being a heel who can, I guess, quote, draw money. I just would love to see him get punched in the face. When Big Show knocked him out last week, I popped. I thought it was great. When they did Miz TV with Cena and Bryan before SummerSlam, and Bryan threatened to punch Miz in the face if he didn't shut up, I was hoping he would punch him in the face anyway, just because he can. And when he said that, the crowd popped. Why? Why do you think that is? Because they don't like The Miz. They don't like him either. His own father doesn't even like him. I still think that'd be an entertaining angle to have Mr. Miz randomly appear in the corner of whoever the opponent is for The Miz and just stare a hole through his son at ringside. Just stare him down to the point where it distracts The Miz, and then when he turns around, boom, he gets clobbered and pinned. Like a Jedi mind trick. As far as feuding with Bryan, I mean, maybe if they were having a slow month or two, I could see that, and they could play off their history from season one of NXT when Miz was Bryan's pro. If they play off that, I think it could work. But turning him heel is essential in making that work, because I just cannot buy into this guy as a hero. I just can't. It's not that I have anything against the guy personally. Some of what I say is in jest. I don't really want people to walk up to him on the street and punch him in the face. I didn't even think he was half bad in that Marine 3 movie, as preposterous as it was to see him being the main tough guy. I'm talking about his character on TV. He's just so easy to hate. Why take away the one good thing about him? Daniel from Toronto, Canada. I am a fairly new listener to the show. I greatly enjoy it and appreciate the work you put into it. As you are someone who interacts with wrestling fans, every now and then you must encounter people who still believe everything is not predetermined. When you talk to these people, do you follow the Star Trek Prime Directive and not interfere with their beliefs, or do you attempt to enlighten them? How old were you when you found out wrestling wasn't real, and how did you feel when you found out? I'd say I generally follow what you call the Prime Directive. I have no idea what that is. But to be honest, it really doesn't happen as often as you probably would think. When I can kind of sense that they're really young, I see no point in ruining the fun for them. I mean, shit, sometimes I wish I could go back to those days. I don't really remember the exact moment I figured out wrestling wasn't real, but it probably would have been when I was about 7 or 8 years old. I do still remember being absolutely mortified when Hulk Hogan was having the life choked out of him by Andre the Giant after one Saturday night's main event match that Hogan had with King Kong Bundy. So that would have been, I think, early 88. Maybe I knew at that point, but still had some doubts. I just remember thinking, he's killing this guy and nobody is saving him. Wrestlers were coming out to pull him off Hogan, and Andre would just swat them away. And then finally, I think Jim Duggan came in and broke a 2x4 over Andre's back. It was quite the traumatizing angle for me, I have to say. Not as traumatizing as some of the angles I've seen as an adult, but those were traumatizing in a different way. And then I think they went to commercial on that show, if I remember, and there may have been an ad for Burger King, and I got all excited. It's like, hamburgers over Hulkamania, that's my motto. But I could tell you the exact moment when I learned there was a wrestling underground, because I definitely remember this. I don't know what else to call it, because you didn't have all the internet sites back then like you do now, but the behind-the-scenes stuff, it was 1992. I'm at recess at school, and there was a phone booth in the lobby downstairs. I know this is a foreign concept for many of you, the idea that you'd have to go into a booth to make a phone call, but yes, these things did actually exist. And so a bunch of the other kids all piled into this phone booth to make a call, and they're all listening, and I have no idea what's going on. All of a sudden, the kid with the receiver in his ear goes, "Ric Flair is winning the Royal Rumble." I had no concept of wrestling hotlines back then, so when I sat down, I think it was like a week later, to watch the pay-per-view with my dad, my brother, and some other people, they asked me, you know, who I thought was going to win, and I said Ric Flair. And they thought I was nuts. They were convinced it was either going to be Hogan or Sid. It was going to be one of the two. So when Flair won, I was the smartest guy in the room. I'll never forget that. That'd be a good question to pose to you guys, too. When did you first realize wrestling wasn't what it seemed to be? I could tell you that it didn't change my opinion about it at all. I didn't like it any less. This question comes from Danny. Should Jack Tunney be inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame? Was there any beef between him and the company? Because I remember reading that when Tunney died, nobody from WWE came to his funeral. That is true. I don't even think they announced it on TV or on the website either. It was almost like the dude didn't exist. And, I mean, just to give some background on Tunney, Tunney was always the figurehead president of the World Wrestling Federation. He never actually had an official title like that. When Gorilla Monsoon took over and became president, just like when Shawn Michaels was the commissioner, it was all for show, for storyline. But Tunney and his brother Frank, they promoted events up in the Toronto area, and they became very instrumental in getting WWF into that city. So they would promote a whole bunch of WWF events up there every single year. They helped keep WCW out of that area, which made it a very strong area for Vince McMahon and for WWF. And, you know, he was made the president, I think it was 85. It was probably around the time of the first WrestleMania that Tunney became the storyline president for WWE. But, you know, he was still just basically a regional promoter. And it was in 95, which I think is when the company let him go. I guess Vince McMahon just made the decision, you know, we don't need Tunney anymore. We're going to promote our own shows up in Canada, up in Toronto. Again, we just don't need Jack anymore. And so they got rid of him. And I don't know if it was an acrimonious parting, if maybe Tunney didn't take it very kindly, and who knows, maybe he told Vince McMahon to, you know, go fuck himself or something like that. But, you know, even if he did that, it just seems awfully petty to me. And all these years have gone by, and Jack Tunney, for those of us who grew up in that era where he was the head authority figure, and when you take that into account with the fact that he promoted for so many years, he was an important figure in wrestling history. And all the people they've put into the Hall of Fame, absolutely, I think Jack Tunney deserves a spot. Is he going to go in? I don't think he is. I think if he was going to go in, he would have already gone in. And I think the fact that he died, and it was almost like it didn't even happen. I mean, in recent years, you do see mentions of him on WWE.com. I think it was a CM Punk once even name-dropped him in a promo, I think, on TV. But never anything official from the company's end. It's almost like, again, he wasn't important. He didn't exist. I think that's a slap in the face, quite frankly. And whatever may or may not have happened between the two sides when he got cut, when he got fired, I absolutely think he deserves to be honored. I think he at least deserves an induction into the Hall of Fame so people can, especially newer fans, can find out exactly who he was. And not just from his television role, but what he also did for them behind the scenes. He was very instrumental in their growth in the 80s. You can't ignore that. This comes from Michael. When Sheamus comes back, do you think he'll be put in the administration since he's known to be good friends with Triple H? Also, can you explain why, in response to last week's mailbag question about what you would ask Vince McMahon, you mentioned the year 1995, I remember some of the things that happened that year, but not all, would you be so kind as to explain, and please don't use any curse words? Oh, a PG request. I think I can handle that. Sheamus is only thought of as a friend of Triple H's, you know, behind the scenes. I think they used to work out together. One or both of them have mentioned that in interviews before. On TV, as a character, it really wouldn't make much sense. But I would prefer that Sheamus be a heel when he comes back, so maybe they could work it where he comes back seeking revenge on Daniel Bryan for putting him out of action, which is what I suggested in that Yahoo column I did on Sheamus about a month ago. That may well be the best way to tie him in with Triple H's new group. They both have that mutual desire to see Daniel Bryan fail. And that question about 1995, I said that if I could ask Vince three questions, one of them would simply be, 1995, what were you thinking? That's actually the sanitized version of what I said last week. And the reason is, I would love to know what was going through his mind when he came up with all of those ridiculous gimmicks, one after the other after the other. What was he partaking in, some chemical assistance, perhaps? I mean, we had Duke the Dumpster Drozzi, who was a garbage man by day. We had T.L. Hopper, the wrestling plumber, who would come to the ring with a toilet plunger named Betsy. We had the Goon, who played hockey, or used to, but got thrown out for being too violent or something. Or maybe I'm mixing that up with Antonio Cesaro's rugby gimmick. And he wore boots that were made to look like ice skates. Chris Jericho actually claimed that gimmick was meant for him. I guess because his dad used to play in the NHL. He had a chance to go to WWE in 95. And thankfully for him, he turned it down. And we're just scratching the surface here. I could go on and on. Okay, Mantar, half man, half minotaur. And he would moo. He would moo at his opponents like a cow. I mean, do minotaurs moo? I've never seen one, so I don't know. I'm pretty sure they put Jim Cornette with him as a rib on Cornette. How could we forget Jerry Lawler's evil dentist, Dr. Isaac Yankum? Do you remember where Isaac Yankum was billed from? Decatur, Illinois. Get it? Decatur? Yeah, very clever. Aldo Montoya, the Portuguese man of war, who wore a bright yellow jock strap on his face. That's why he's kind of the bastard child of the clique. He was friends with all those guys, but you never really hear about him with the clique. Then we had Jean-Pierre Lafitte, the evil pirate, who once stole Bret Hart's jacket. Yes, they built an entire storyline and pay-per-view match around him stealing Bret Hart's leather jacket and Bret fighting to get it back. Pierre was actually a really good wrestler. He was a big bumper, but he just got saddled with a terrible gimmick. Techno Team 2000, dear God. These guys wore futuristic-looking outfits like they were either from the future or they represented the future of wrestling or something ridiculous like that. If they were really from the future, it's too bad they couldn't go back in time and save themselves from this awful gimmick. Dean Douglas is another one. Shane Douglas, former ECW champion, the man who threw down the NWA World Heavyweight title and helped start a revolution in pro wrestling, debuted as a college dean. I think he debuted in the summer, and to show you how successful the gimmick was, he was gone from the company by December. And according to him, we have the clique to thank for that one. Al Snow went through a couple of gimmicks that year. He wore a mask for both of them. First, he was Avatar. I'm not even sure what he was supposed to be. And then he was Shinobi, the Black Ninja. I think there was a Nintendo game called Shinobi. He was brought in by Jim Cornette to rid the WWF of Shawn Michaels. Even the women, when they had women's wrestling, they had a division back then. Even the women were not spared that year. Ronda Singh made a name for herself wrestling in Japan as Monster Ripper. But when she came over to WWF, she morphed into Bertha Faye, the girlfriend of Harvey Whippleman, who lived in a trailer park. And as bad as her character was, her theme music was 10 times worse. And I remember reading that management supposedly had asked her not to do any of the big power moves that the males did. And, I mean, when she was in Japan, she was Monster Ripper. So you can imagine the kind of offense that she had over in Japan. And they basically stripped it all away and said, nope, can't do that. So they turned her into just a complete comedy figure. They killed any chance of people taking her seriously in the ring. She did win the women's title that year, but they thought so much of that division, they fired the champion and didn't bring the title back for another 3 years. So, obviously, they didn't really think very much of that championship. So now, hopefully, you see what I'm talking about here. I mean, there were some ridiculous gimmicks in the early 90s, too, that I grew up on, in the 80s as well. I just can't ever remember an entire year just full of one bad character after another. But for all the bad gimmicks, there was one that I liked that year that I think had a lot of potential. And the only reason it didn't work was because it never had a chance. Waylon Mercy, who was played by Danny Spivey, I thought was a great gimmick. Spivey's body was shot at that point. I think he had a bad back. He really couldn't do much in the ring. If you watched a lot of the matches he had in 95, they really weren't that great. He just couldn't do it, and he had to retire. He actually retired, I think, at the end of the year. Fast forward to 2013, and in Bray Wyatt, I think you see shades of that Waylon Mercy character, especially with the quiet, creepy way he talks in his promos. I think if Spivey were 5 years younger, I think he could have had some success with that character.
History has been made here!
This week, in wrestling history, we got some good ones this week. 48 years ago this week, on September 27, 1965, after successfully defending his WWF championship at Madison Square Garden against Tarzan Tyler, Bruno Sammartino went out to eat at a restaurant in Times Square. When he got back to his car, he discovered that somebody had shattered one of the windows and stolen his title belt. That belt cost a reported $10,000 and was never recovered. So somebody has a nice souvenir in their attic somewhere. 26 years ago this week, on September 23, 1987, at a Saturday night's main event taping in Hershey, Pennsylvania, Macho Man Randy Savage beat the Honky Tonk Man by disqualification. The Hart Foundation and Honky all ganged up on Savage after the match while Elizabeth went to the back and brought out with her Hulk Hogan to help save Savage. This was the birth of the Mega Powers tag team and the handshake. I know you know what handshake I'm talking about. To this day, when I meet somebody new at a business meeting, I can't help but grab my own wrist before I shake their hand. 20 years ago this week, on September 27, 1993, at a live Raw taping, so it was one live show, one tape show, WWF announced that Shawn Michaels had been stripped of his Intercontinental Championship for failure to defend the title within the required 30 days. In reality, Shawn was suspended for a positive steroid test, although I think he denies that story to this day. I never read his book, but I think he talks about it in there, and he does not admit to it. It was announced that a new champion would be crowned in a 20-man over-the-top rope battle royal, but with a twist. The last two men in the ring would square off in a singles match on Raw the following week to crown a new champion. And those two men were Razor Ramon and the model Rick Martel. Ramon would pin Martel on that second show to win his first Intercontinental title, his first of four. Because Michaels reportedly refused to send the Intercontinental belt back to the company, they had a new one made for Ramon, and when Michaels did come back, he did so with the original strap, and they turned it into a storyline with him claiming that he was the real Intercontinental champion. 17 years ago this week, on September 23rd, 1996, on Monday Night Raw, Wild Man Mark Marrow beat Farouk in the finals of a tournament to crown a new Intercontinental Champion. Mr. Perfect celebrated with him afterwards. This was the beginning of the big swerve, the Perfect hoax I talked about last week in the mailbag, orchestrated by Mr. Perfect and a young Triple H. This show also featured the infamous Jim Ross heel turn, the first heel turn, not the second one, which saw Jim Ross actually cut one hell of a promo, I thought, in the middle of the ring about being stricken with Bell's palsy, being fired by Vince McMahon, and how all of these big names you see leaving WWF or WCW, it's not a mistake. It's not happening by mistake. He said, right now I'm going to bring back one of your favorites, and he introduced Razor Ramon, who was played by Big Titan. He competed in Japan a lot. Rick Bogner. It was not Scott Hall, as we would realize. And the new Diesel was actually played by some guy who was originally saddled with a dentist gimmick and would go on to have some measure of success as Undertaker's little baby brother in WWE. But at the time, it was a big cop-out. You know, WWF was struggling. WCW had struck gold with the NWO angle. Hall and Nash became big stars there, along with Hogan and everybody else. And so this was their way of, I guess, bringing back two popular... I don't know what they were trying to accomplish now that I look back on it, because, yeah, true, they owned the Razor and Diesel gimmicks and the names, but everybody knew it wasn't the real Razor and Diesel, and all you did was show your fans how second-rate you were. Like, if you wanted to see the originals, you could watch that other show. Instead, you get the two knockoffs on WWF television, and it's a shame, too, because, you know, Glenn Jacobs, Rick Bogner, I didn't see too much of Bogner. Bogner seemed pretty basic to me. But if the goal was to try to get these guys over and give them a chance to succeed, boy, they didn't get any help from the company. Because you knew that, you know, giving these two guys gimmicks for two guys that were so beloved and were so popular, everybody in the world was going to look at them as two second-rate knockoffs. So these two guys never stood a chance in those gimmicks. They stuck around for a few months, but before long, they were gone. I mean, they really just never had a chance to succeed until they brought, you know, Jacobs back much later on with a much better gimmick. 15 years ago this week, on September 28th, 1998, this was one of my favorite episodes ever of Monday Night Raw. This was the night after the Breakdown In Your House pay-per-view, where Undertaker and Kane got a double pin on Steve Austin in the main event. The championship was held up. It was declared vacant. They had a championship presentation ceremony the next night. Vince McMahon was going to crown a new champion. Whether it was Undertaker or Kane, we'll never know. Steve Austin interrupted the festivities on a Zamboni. Zamboni, for those of you who don't know, is that giant machine they use to clean ice hockey rinks. He rode in on a Zamboni. Of all the vehicles that Austin rode in, the beer truck and the ATV later on, everything else, the monster truck, my favorite was the Zamboni incident. Of all the skits I think they did with Austin and McMahon, this one was maybe not number one, because it's hard to top that hospital skit, but this was way up there. The crowd was going crazy. When Austin drove the Zamboni down to the ring, he knocked out some audio cables. All you could hear was just this loud roar from the crowd and not much else. That segment alone was awesome, but then they went right into the next segment, which was Vince McMahon in the ring with Undertaker and Kane. You know, the red carpet was still out. The title was still, I think, in the glass case. Or maybe the title was out of the ring at that point. But now Vince is angry about what just happened. And instead of announcing a new champion, he puts Undertaker and Kane in a handicap main event against Ken Shamrock, Mankind, and The Rock. And then Vince goes into this diatribe about how, you know, you got two brothers basically that are handicapped. One's physical and the other is mental. And Undertaker and Kane, I mean, Undertaker was awesome here. Basically, he grabs Vince. He says, listen, he goes, you better watch your ass, because the next time you get out of line with either one of us, you're going to be the one handicapped. I thought that was such a fucking awesome line. So he lets Vince go. Vince puts the mic down. He's about to leave. Undertaker turns his back. Kane turns his back. And Vince goes to flip him the double bird. But Undertaker spins around just in time to catch him. And they beat the holy hell out of Vince McMahon. And the place goes nuts. Again, everyone's just flipping out, going crazy like they were 10 minutes earlier. Undertaker is just, he puts a submission hold, like a leg lock on Vince. They drag Vince out of the ring, pick up the ring steps. They smash his ankle. They break his ankle. I mean, people were just going bonkers throughout both of these segments. And I have to say, you know, this was, I don't know how much of this influence was Russo and how much of it was McMahon. But this was Vince Russo back at his finest when he was in WWF and working with Vince McMahon. You could have segments like this with the right people, and people would go nuts for it. This was great television. And I give him and everybody else, you know, who worked on this stuff back then a lot of credit. They had to keep coming up with innovative ideas for how to keep Austin McMahon fresh. And they incorporated all these other guys like Undertaker and Kane and Rock and Mankind. That's why these guys were the nucleus of the product back then. And they were just firing. They were firing on all cylinders. They didn't have the same PG handcuffs they have now, which does make a difference. And so it made for great television. Both of these segments, by the way, made my top 30 list of greatest Raw moments of all time. I think they were number 3 out of 30 on my list. That's how much I love this stuff. 14 years ago this week, on September 26, 1999, WWE held its Unforgiven pay-per-view in Charlotte, North Carolina, what would turn out to be the final WWE pay-per-view of the Vince Russo era that I just mentioned. It was a show that featured one of the worst matches in company history, maybe in wrestling history, the epic fail that was the Kennel from Hell match. It was Al Snow against the Big Boss Man inside a steel cage surrounded by the Hell in a Cell. So a cage within a cage. Now, in theory, sounds kind of cool. In practice, not so much. Snow and Boss Man had a feud going on at the time that largely centered around Boss Man cooking Al Snow's pet chihuahua, Pepper, and serving it to Al Snow as Pepper steak. So the idea here was that they would have these vicious dogs, I think they were Rottweilers, circling the ring between the cell and the cage, kind of like in the pit down there. Sounds pretty cool. The dogs would be barking, they'd be growling. Every time somebody would try to escape, the dogs would practically be scaling the cage to get to them, to bite them and prevent them from getting out, or if, you know, otherwise you risk getting torn to shreds by these violent beasts. And unfortunately for them, it didn't quite work out that way. The dogs were not cooperating on this night. Many of them congregated on one side of the cage, which made it pretty tough to sell how dangerous climbing out would be, being that the dogs couldn't give a shit about what was going on. They spent most of their time humping each other and peeing on the floor, which reminds me of my college days. I do have to say this, though. When you look at the feuds that the Big Boss Man was involved in 1999... I love Boss Man as the hardcore champion, and as ridiculous as the stuff with Pepper was, cooking up Al Snow's dog and making him eat it, then feuding with Big Show for the WWE title, and sabotaging his father's funeral by dragging the casket behind his car through the cemetery, find me a better heel than the Big Boss Man. You look at what Boss Man did to those two guys, and find me a bigger scumbag in the history of wrestling. The only thing left to top that would be to kick a small child or tip over an old lady's wheelchair, both of which I'm sure the Boss Man gladly would have done. That dude was cold as ice. And what about that sympathy card that he read on Raw? Remember that one time he read the sympathy card? Big Show's father had passed away for real. Well, technically it wasn't real. I think Big Show's father actually passed away many years before. But the first angle of the feud actually had the Boss Man sending a fake cop out to tell the Big Show his father had died of cancer. Then we found out that it was all a ruse, his father didn't die, but then I think in storyline his father finally did die. And they did a 10-bell salute on Raw, and in the middle of the 10-bell salute, the Big Boss Man's music hits. And he comes down to the ring, and he has a sympathy card that he wanted to read to the Big Show.
With the deepest regrets and tears that are soaked, I'm sorry to hear your dad finally croaked. He lived a full life on his own terms. Soon he'll be buried and eaten by worms. But if I could have a son as stupid as you, I'd have wished for cancer so I would die too.
In the main event of that show, Triple H won a six-pack challenge over Rock, Mankind, Kane, Big Show, and the British Bulldog to win back the vacant WWE title he had lost to Vince McMahon. Steve Austin, out with an injury, he served as the special guest enforcer, which largely just consisted of him doing commentary at ringside until the last 5 minutes of the match. They had this great spot where a bunch of referees came down and dragged, I think it was Jimmy Corderas, out of the ring and beat him up because they were doing a storyline where all the referees had gone on strike. And Corderas was a scab, you see, and so he had to pay. Austin, on headset, was completely appalled by this. He ran over, he beat the shit out of every single one of those striking referees. In the end, Triple H got the pin on Rock after Bulldog nailed him with a chair, and then Triple H nailed the pedigree. Finish fell real flat. You know, seeing Austin count the fall for Triple H is not what the people wanted to see. Thankfully, he turned them around after the match by giving Triple H a stunner, and everybody cheered. 13 years ago this week, on September 24, 2000, Stone Cold Steve Austin made his return to WWE television after spinal fusion surgery the year prior at the Unforgiven pay-per-view in Philadelphia. He had returned earlier in the year at Backlash to mow down six people with a steel chair and help Rock beat Triple H to win the WWF title, but then he disappeared again, so this was his official return. The storyline was that Austin was looking to find out the identity of the person who ran him down with a car at Survivor Series the year before. Shane McMahon tried to show video evidence, video proof that implicated Steve Blackman as the assailant, since Shane was feuding with Blackman at the time. Blackman came out, Shane bailed, out came Austin to a monster pop. First time he ever came out to that Disturbed theme music. Austin played along like he bought into Shane's BS and then laid out Blackman with a stunner, shared a few beers with Shane O'Mac before laying him out with three Stone Cold stunners. And Jim Ross was awesome here, because after Austin laid out Shane, Ross was just freaking out on commentary, and he had this great line where he said, you know, Austin knew that Shane McMahon was being nothing but a pain in the ass. And I remember hearing that, and it's just, I can't imagine anybody on commentary saying anything like that these days. Forget the word ass, like, I understand, like, no curse words, but I just mean saying it the way that Ross would say it. Like, do it in your own style, but everything just seems so formulaic these days. Like, I feel like going back and watching some of those old matches with Jim Ross on commentary is like the worst thing that a current wrestling fan could do, because you're just going to watch it and come away all depressed, so you're probably better off not even watching it. 8 years ago this week, on September 29, 2005, CM Punk officially made his WWE debut in Ohio Valley Wrestling, its developmental territory at the time. He beat Danny Inferno in a match where Inferno caught Punk for real with a shot right to the face. I don't think there's ever been a time when Punk wasn't all beat up. Even on day one, he was getting the hell beat out of him in that ring. And finally, 1 year ago this week, on September 24, 2012, on Monday Night Raw, John Cena attempted to get CM Punk, the WWE champion, to accept his challenge for a match at Hell in a Cell. Punk refused. He said Cena gets plenty of title matches as it is, which is undoubtedly true. He said there are plenty of others who deserve a shot at the champion. Punk turned his back and told Cena he was going to give him until the count of five to leave, or else he was going to get his ass kicked. Cena, who had elbow surgery and was still recovering, he took out a lead pipe that he had hidden in his pants and hit Punk with it. So, what a babyface. Backstage, Punk walked right by Mick Foley. I don't even remember why Foley was there. But he walked by him, and then he ended up kicking Foley in the knee. But when Punk looked up, he saw Ryback staring a hole through him. And this was the first sign that they were going to do something meaningful with Ryback, because up until that point, all Ryback did was beat a bunch of jobbers in two-on-one, three-on-one matches. So there was Ryback staring right back at Punk. That was their backup plan if John Cena was not able to go at the pay-per-view, which he was not. They went with Ryback and Punk at Hell in a Cell instead. John Cena out after elbow surgery, and Ryback versus CM Punk at the October pay-per-view. I swear, it's like Groundhog Day. It really is. That's going to do it for this week in wrestling history. A lot of stuff happening this week, as there is every week. You can send me questions for the mailbag, thesolemonster, at gmail.com is the email address to send any and all inquiries. You can follow me on Twitter, at solemonster is my handle. On my March to 3,000, that's the new hashtag I'm going to use. Hopefully by this time next week, I'll have 3,000 followers on Twitter, and hopefully you are one of them. You can also friend us on Facebook, facebook.com/thesolemonster, all one word. We also have a official Sound Off Facebook group, which is a closed group, so you can find it, send a request for membership, I will approve you. We are now well over 500 members in this group, lots of good, healthy discussion going on each and every day, so be part of that discussion. Join us in that group. Don't forget, we now have an official Sound Off Superstore, solemonster.spreadshirt.com. You can get the official Solemonster Sounds Off logo t-shirt, different colors, sizes. There's a Ringer t-shirt there as well if you're into Ringer shirts. Please do support the show. There'll be more stuff added to that store in the weeks ahead. And if you have any ideas for anything you'd like to see, by all means, email me, drop me a line, and let me know. And we'll see if we can get that done for you. Also, just to mention it here, next Sunday is my birthday, October 6th. I am still planning on doing a show. I don't know if it'll be quite as long as it normally is. Maybe it'll be a slightly abbreviated version, but I am still planning to do episode 295 next weekend. We'll have predictions for Battleground and all the late-breaking news coming up this week. And boy, I can't think of a better birthday gift than making a PayPal donation or buying a shirt. I'm just saying. Until next time, be well, stay safe. We'll see you right back here for episode 295 next week. Until then, take care, guys.
You've been listening to the Solemonster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
Daniel Bryan's been unstoppable!
the Bad.
Raw is now 3 hours every Monday at 8.
And the Ugly.
Hello.
Why does Jerry Lawler insist on telling us that we are just getting started? What the fuck have I been watching for the past 2 hours?
Well, mostly the good.
I don't want to K-Fab you.
You're going to K-Fab me?
Salamonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007 on thesalamonster.com, iTunes, and Stitcher Radio, The Salamonster Sounds Off.